Hey everybody, this is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine, and this is Rattlecast number 36. We have Catherine Barron-Sweat here with us, who's going to be joining us in just a bit. Thanks so much for joining us. Let me make sure everything's working before we get going, but it looks like it is. As always, Rattle is a publication of the Rattle Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit working to promote the practice of poetry. We've been in continuous publication since 1995. Yeah, 2000 is much more recent than we started. We just do this because we love poetry. So the way you can help is by clicking the like button, sharing, and telling your friends to subscribe. That's really all there is to it. We appreciate when you do that. That's how things pop up on the watch next and your Facebook streams and all that stuff. Now to start out, we usually do a warm-up poem, and I would like to start out with today's poem. I just thought it's by Ted Kooser, and it's a poet response poem about the current coronavirus crisis that everybody's experiencing. And if you haven't seen it yet, we have an open mic show for poet response poems every Sunday morning. But I couldn't read this last Sunday. I knew this was coming up, but we couldn't read it because it was forthcoming still. So I thought I'd read it here. It's been really interesting to see, you know, poets' takes from all over the country about what's going on right now. And it's interesting to hear, think about Ted Kooser in his house in Nebraska, thinking about COVID-19. And here's, this is A Pretty Pass by Ted Kooser. Things have come to a pretty pass, mother, as you'd be saying today, when the mailman's afraid of the mail, up at our box by the road, extending a latex-gloved hand from his Jeep to put in my earlier letter to you, stamped, return to sender, address unknown. But I'm trying again. I've been wanting to tell you that the address you left behind, that of your house on slow 29th Street, its shutters nailed open, never meant to shut out anything. That open-windowed world is gone, and the world that replaced it isn't one that you'd recognize. The mailman wearing disposable gloves, and neighbors quarantined in their houses as they wait for a little good news. And although you resisted it fiercely, perched in your chair by your front window's familiar view, your sewing basket always within reach for making new things, for making things new or nearly new, mending and darning at a time when the world was still mendable, I'd say you were lucky to go when you did. And that was Ted Kooser. Ted Kooser was the 13th U.S. Poet Laureate from 2004-2006, and his book Delights and Shadows won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book is Kindest Regards. So I thought that'd be a good warm-up poem to share. And now let's bring in our guest. Now, Catherine Barron-Sweat won the 2019 Donald Justice Prize for Voice Message. She's a high school English teacher living in New York City. She has a PhD in American Literature from Columbia University. Her poems have been published in various journals, including the lyric here at Rattle, four poems from this book, Mezzocamon, the Raintown Review, and the Orchard Poetry Journal. And her sonnets were finalists for the Nemirov contest in 2016 and 2017. She also has a chapbook called 21 from Finishing Line Press a few years ago. You can find more about this book, Voice Message, at autumnhouse.org. And here she is, Catherine Barron-Sweat. Hey, Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm great. It's really great to see you. And you're in New York City, right? Or are you upstate from New York?
State right now. Uh-huh. So not in New York because I'm teaching virtually or online.
Uh-huh. So. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to start us out with a poem?
All right. I thought I would just start with the title poem of the collection.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Which is a sonnet called Voice Message. My brother's wife still answers when I call, and he's not picking up. I say, it's me, just saying hi, not anything at all. I'm sure he senses my anxiety. He picks up halfway through. Hello, hold on. He turns it off. His voice is clear. He sounds okay. He's there. Maybe he will hold on. Amazing how the human soul rebounds. I think her voice is like a rickety bridge suspended there above a roaring creek that rushes through a narrow mountain gorge. Approaching grief is never for the meek. She's gone. It's just my brother on the line who seems to tell me, sure, I'm here. I'm fine.
Thanks so much, Catherine. That was Voice Message, the title poem from Catherine Barrett Sweat's newest book, Voice Message. Do you want to introduce a little bit what the book is about?
Of course. So it has three sections, and it's many of the poems in the book are about my daughter, who died after a skiing accident in 2010. But poems are also about Vermeer. I have a crown of sonnets about Vermeer's paintings. And I have poems about my marriage and just a lot of different topics. I teach English, so there are some poems about other poets as well as the ones about the painter Vermeer. So there's a variety of poems, but most of them are in form, though there are some free verse poems as mm-hmm. well. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, that's what one thing as I was wondering about after reading the book was about. It felt like your daughter died in a ski accident, but I wasn't exactly sure if I was interpreting that right. And when it was, too, I was kind of wondering about that. So these are mostly poems written after that. Is that?
That's true. There are some earlier poems that met with the theme of the different sections. For example, the third section is called Marginalia. Mm-hmm. And involves mostly poems that are about literary works, and marginalia is what people write in the margins of books when they're reading. So these are sort of poems conceived of as marginalia, as responses to other texts. Mm-hmm. So some of those are earlier, but most of the other poems were written in the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. And the poems about death are just such heartbreaking poems, and the form puts it together so beautifully. Why is it that you, like, how did you get into writing formal poetry? It always feels to me like formal poets are in a sort of club that's very similar to the haiku community, where there's this little, really tight-knit, wonderful community. But if you look at, like, the acknowledgments at the back, you know, it's the same journals that publish form, you know, Mezzocamin, Lyric Magazine, Raintown Review, stuff like that. The only one missing is Hudson Review, but you kind of got all of them in there. Do you feel like there's a community around form, and why did you get into writing form? Why is it? What does that do for you?
I think there really is a community. I think I was writing in form before I found that community. So, I think it really came out of my education and also my upbringing. We read poetry when I was a child, and I loved people like Dorothy Parker and Ogden Nash, as well as, you know, Robert Frost and So I just think that formal poetry was part of my heritage. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered that there were people out there who actually enjoyed writing mm-hmm. it still. Because, of course, many poets don't enjoy it, or they enjoy reading it, but they don't like writing it. And I like free verse as well. Mm-hmm. And my first chapbook actually was free verse.
Oh,
that
was it?
The first mm-hmm. haiku. To it.
Well, the interesting thing about form is that the number one criticism that we get when an issue comes out is people say, you know, it's all free verse. Where's your form of poetry? And then I say, well, if you want more form of poetry, write formal poetry. It's not that hard. Like, we're looking for it. I love formal verse. I love the way things click together and just it feels so sort of complete when it works. And it sort of amplifies the quality of the poem to me. I like writing in form. I like reading poems in form. But it's the fact that like 5% maybe of submissions are formal poems. And I really don't know why that is when people seem like they want formal poetry more. Do you have any thoughts about that? I always feel like saying like, you know, put your money where your mouth is and buy a book like Voice Message or something, you know, if there's...
Well, thank you for saying that. I people will listen to you. I just think it's fashion, and it's been, I mean, people have always written sonnets. I mean, maybe in the 18th century, not too many sonnets were written, but so it's not as if these forms really die, even though sometimes people want to say, oh, the sonnet is dead. But I think free verse is what people think a poem is right now. And I don't know if that will change. I do think that we have an eclectic group of poems out there. I mean, I get those 2 poems a day from poetry.org and also from the Poetry Foundation. And it is rare to have a formal poem in poetry.org's offerings of poem a day. The Poetry Foundation has more formal poetry. So I tell my students, sign up for both of them and you'll get a really great variety. So.
Well, you want to read a couple more poems from the book? And I should say too, if anybody has any questions for Catherine, I'm watching both chat on Facebook and YouTube, mostly YouTube. So if you have any questions for Catherine, ask them there and I will pass them along.
Okay, so I'm just gonna. I have an epigraph in the first part of the book, and it's from John Donne, who's a poet I adore and also teach. And it explains a little bit about why I thought, in particular, this book with this material made sense in formal verse. And it's a poem of his called The Triple Fool. And he wrote, grief brought to numbers cannot be so fierce, for he tames it that fetters it in verse. And numbers, of course, means rhyme and meter. So that idea of using form to contain something that in most ways feels uncontainable or inexpressible. So I think form helps. Right now, I, like everyone, I'm writing poems about the coronavirus, and many of them are in form because it helps me. So I recommend trying it because sometimes it makes things easier. That being said, should I read a free verse poem?
Yeah, that'd be a perfect segue.
Okay. There are 2 short poems, 2 woodcuts.
And say the page number too, so I can show it for people.
Oh, it's on page 4 and 5.
Okay.
And the first one is called Red Fuji, which is a woodcut by Hokusai. And I went to Japan with my daughter Rachel the year before she died. So these are 2 poems about that trip. Very short. Sleeping daughter in the next bed, I woke to Red Fuji. Every morning wakes to my daughter still dead. You should have woken me, she later said. Summer day, Boston, Hokusai exhibit, Fuji, blue and red. 2. Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. Everywhere in the park, light and peace surround a monumental grief. Fierce, not dark, the open wound, not the hard scar, paper around floating fire.
Is there another poem from Voice Message? It's interesting that you said that's free verse because, knowing, most of the book, I read that and I was thinking, what form is that that I don't know? Is this syllabic? I was like counting syllables. I mean, there's the rhyme in there, and so I was thinking like, what form is this? So I'm glad you said that. Kind of throws you off a little bit. But a beautiful poem. And I don't know, do you want to talk about how poetry helps come to terms with grief? There's a way that sort of poems are containers for loss or something, so you can put them outside of yourself. Do you have that experience? Like, do you feel more healed for writing these poems?
Well, the chat book, which was poems sort of similar to that, very short 3-line poems, really, I wrote those poems right after Rachel died, and so that really was part of my grieving. And then I revised them and kind of and about a year after, and so I think that was at a different stage in my grieving. So that helped that process of sort of putting them together into some kind of coherence, because obviously they came out of a very chaotic moment. The poems in this book were written over the course of about 6 or 7 years, and I mean, one of them that was published in Rattle and that I will read, called Marginalia, really describes an experience I think so many people have, which is that I was reading one of my daughter's college books, and I found her little notations in it. And it's that desire to hear the person's voice in the margins of the book. And it was also Freud, and it was about Freudian slip, so it had all kinds of resonance for me. But I think that experience is a very common one. You can have it also about clothing. It's not just books and marginalia books. So I think it's something. And when I wrote a lot of these poems, I did think I could write these poems. I'm a writer, and maybe that's something I can give to other people who have experienced losses. Mm-hmm. Many, many people out there go through what we went through. So
yeah, yeah. Do you want to read that poem Marginalia now? It's a good introduction to it.
So just a note that Flubber is a 1997 movie. I really don't remember it very well, but I think it's Rachel's favorites. It's about a nutty professor, Robin Williams, who keeps missing his wedding. So it's a kind of Freudian slip, kind of, right? He misses his wedding because he really wanted to be there. So this poem is called Marginalia, and the section of the book, which is also called Marginalia, also has an epigraph. One poet told me this was a hangover from my PhD, that I have to give everything epigraphs. In the Marginalia too, we talk only to ourselves. We therefore talk freshly, boldly, originally, with abandonment, without conceit. And that's Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I must have skipped that over as I was reading the book, but that's a cool, cool quote. I like that.
Right. Who reads it? Who reads epigraphs? They're there. okay. Marginalia. I read my daughter's old Freud, her college book, An Introduction to Parapraxis, How We Avoid Significance in Small Disruptions. I read her margin notes, quick summaries and explanations of his points. What's lost is her. I want to hear her make some crack to roast the guy. I turn the page. Nearer. She writes dad by forgetting names, and something makes her jot down flubber. I also look for hints of blame, some scribbled clue about intent, the words that might help me frame the subsequent event. Then this. If worried about a slip, tend to. Does that make it real or accident? A friend said she stopped at the top. We'll never know why she paused. To catch the sun, check out the slope. Likely a patch of ice caused. No way to know or to avoid. She used to why, and I'd because. But now all answers are destroyed.
Yeah, that's Marginalia from Voice Message. One of the really heartbreaking poems in the book. Was she an avid skier? We live in a ski town, and we never go skiing. I'm terrified of it, seeing all the ambulances, coming back and forth, and in the helicopters occasionally. Was she a regular, a lover of skiing?
She did love skiing, and my husband was the skier. I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't ski. Pretty unathletic all around. But she skied and her brothers and they really did enjoy it. And she was in New Zealand on a study abroad program, and she was very excited to go skiing in June because Northern Hemisphere people, so mm-hmm. it's a winter thing.
Oh, she wasn't even in the U.S. at the time?
No, she was down in New Zealand.
Oh man, that must have been hard. Jackie McManus asked a question about how books are composed. She says, it sounds like your book is composed of many different subjects. It's easier to title a themed book. So how did you narrow down or decide on a title? It's a good question, Voice Message. I was wondering that too. Of all the poems in the book, I wondered why that one was the title.
Right. I think that it's because I like this idea of people who are gone and literature and painting leave these messages for us and we try to understand them, but we also respond to them. And so the thing I like about voice message is it's both ends of it, right? It's the message that someone leaves on their phone that you get when you call them and they're not there. But it's also the message you leave for them. So I like that idea that we strive to have this kind of reciprocal relationship with the past, though of course we can't. So I think, and that theme is really present in so many of the poems. So it is unified in that sense.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you said that because I hadn't really thought of it like that, but that makes a lot of sense. And two, why we write poems in general, why we make art is one way to keep communicating even after we're gone is one of the most important things about it, I think. Yeah, I like that a lot. It's a great metaphor for a lot of things. Do you want to read a couple more poems?
Okay, so maybe I'll read some less sad poems.
Sure.
All right, so why don't I read two poems that are about my husband? He's a photographer. This one is called What Can't Be. The sky above sinks deep into a lake. Storefronts emerge from windows on a bus. These double shots photographers all take dissolve the distances that sever us. The sunset pours out from the sliding glass. A woman still inside holds out a tray. A swimming pool is sprinkled with cut grass. And clouds the children scatter as they play. Large monuments appear inside sunglasses. Green trees stand framed inside the fireplace. A man glares through a windshield as he passes. And in my pupils, you see your drowned face. And your brown eyes give my face back to me. So mirrors make what can't be seem to be. So that poem owes a little bit in its imagery to, well, to photographers who love to take pictures of reflections, and photographs are not exactly reflections, but it sort of complicates our perception of reality when we're looking at something reflected within something within a photograph. So the imagery there owes a little something to, again, to John Donne. But this is a poem that takes its title from Donne, and it is called The Sun Rising. So it's also a sonnet, but it is also an aubade, which is a morning poem, often a poem of lovers saying farewell in the morning. And Donne's poem is about we assume, a young couple. And they're just very irritated that the sun has come in to wake them up. And so the first line is, "Busy old fool," and that's John Donne. And my poem is about an older couple have a slightly different point of view. While all across the town they're waking up to curse the clock and make their morning tea, to rouse the kids or walk the restless pup and look back at their bedrooms longingly. I think the sun's fantastic, rising up and pouring in with youthful yellow gleam, and squeezing orange in my reddish cup, and slipping in the curtains as I dream. Old fools, we're lying in the bed we made, for nothing else is calling to us now, escaping summer's heat and oaken shade, a lazy bull and even lazier cow. We, unlike those young fools, now realize that one day our sun will, in fact, not rise.
That was The Sun Rising from Voice Message. Catherine, do you want to talk a little bit about your process for writing in form? We talked about form a little bit already, and And I mentioned that people always ask for more form, but then they don't submit it very often. And I wonder, maybe it's because people feel intimidated by the thought of it or something. Is there a reason? Are there any advice that you have, or is there a way that you go about approaching something like a sonnet? Like, do you lay things out? Do you write it linearly? Is it a lot of revision? How do you go about that?
Unless I'm writing a real sequence of sonnets, I don't necessarily know a poem is going to be a sonnet when I start writing it. But I have an idea and it starts falling into that structure of the sonnet. And so that's why it becomes a sonnet. The logic is very clear in a sonnet. You have the turn, you have a nice number of lines, a nice square shape on the page. One of the things I love about it is that it speeds up so that you have the first 8 lines that are kind of a chunk, and then the next four, and then the next two. So it's very nice ratio. It's kind of mathematical. So something I write might feel like that to me. So then I think, okay, this is a sonnet. I mean, my advice is just to read them. And not read only Shakespeare and Milton and Robert Frost, but read the ones that, in Rattle or they're all over the place. People write them all the time nowadays. I said the sonnet is guaranteed to survive. So just read them and see what's the trick. I mean, it used to be you could read the Nemirov contest winners, and that was sort of good instruction in contemporary sonnets. And I actually did that for a few years. I pulled out the winners. I thought, okay, what is this? What are they doing? And I sort of figured it out. And I discovered the thing that was always present was that very strong turn. A lot of other things could happen in the beginning and at the end, but you had to have that kind of dividing of the poem, open.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that you said it, because I always feel like one important thing that a lot of poems lack, a lot of free verse poems lack, is that sense of movement from one place to another. Like, it's really, if a poem is, I always like to think of a poem as a magic spell that's being cast, you know? And the whole point is to transfer your mental state, your emotional state from one place to another. So there needs to be like this transition from one place to another. And the thing about the sonnet is it lays it out really formally, like where to put that transition. And I don't know, it really makes it maybe easier to do it successfully if you know, if you have that architecture, that scaffolding already set up.
I mean, I had a wonderful teacher, Marie Ponceau, who died last year at age 98 or something, and she said that, write a sonnet a day. And I've gone through various stages doing that, and she said because the point is you throw your standards out the window. If you know most of them are going to be terrible, but then some of them actually might be poems. So that's another piece of advice I was given, and I think is kind of good. I mean, the thing about formal poetry, it gives you another tool. It's like free verse is amazing, but it's harder because in metrical verse you have something that you're pushing against. So if you break the sonnet in the middle of line seven instead of at the end of line eight, that has meaning, right? And people, so it gives you another source of meaning, and that's pleasurable and fun.
Can you say a little bit about the Nemirov Award? Is it still going on? You mentioned that it's.
Stopped. I think, in fact, 2017 might have been the last
Oh,
year.
really? I didn't know that. Do you know why it stopped?
I don't.
That's one of those things that I mentioned before. There's like a little community of formal poets, and that's like the pinnacle, or at least it was, I guess, for formal poets. It seems like everybody entered that competition and took it really seriously. And to win, I think your bio said you were a finalist twice, right? And that's like a huge badge of honor to be included among that company for formal poetry, right? So,
I was.
but they don't do it anymore.
No, it stopped. It had been going on for quite a couple of decades, and I don't know. I mean, I think you know how much work it is to run
Oh
a poetry.
yeah, definitely. Who ran it? Do you know that?
Someone named William Baer was the editor who was in touch with me. And then the poems were published in Measure, with another formalist.
Well, do you want to read a couple more poems?
Okay, so what I want to read what is for me quite a long poem, and it also was published in Rattle, and it's a poem about a writer I love, and I always like to give her a plug, Constance Wolson, who is mostly known because she was a great friend of Henry James, and there have been lots of novels written sort of imagining her relationship with James. But I just really enjoy her novels, and I was thinking about her a few summers ago. And when I was about the age she was when she died, and so I wrote this poem called Dust. Constance Wolson died in Venice, January 24, an apparent suicide. She was not yet 54. Henry James said half one's feeling for her was anxiety. He wrote it repeatedly in letters that scholars find revealing of James's own anxiety. He thought her cheerful manner a facade, as flowers set in the window have nothing to do with what's inside. Did he think how the pots might fall below, the careless maid knocking them off the windowsill? His metaphor is shocking, as Wilson was the pot that fell. She would hate the bios and novels about her lovelorn melancholy. She was a writer who wanted readers, and of course she was lonely, living abroad, far from home, to save money. I reread her novels most years. I like the smell of old papers and books, of library stacks, forgotten lives. I take them like snuff in the afternoon. The past boxed up like Bluebeard's wives. Who isn't lonely as she grows older? I cleaned the embossed spine of East Angels, bought for nothing when secondhand books first went online. I spent hours dusting and wiping each shelf with lavender oil to fight off mildew and soil. The last Christmas, she turned down all invitations. She wanted to be alone with her things and memories. Her gondola wound for miles around the lagoon. I am now her age, and I don't believe she killed herself for love. Hers was a deeper grief, and she was not afraid to die. She wrote that repeatedly. James couldn't get over that suicide is impolite. It seems so out of character, like refusing to eat your host's meat. I think she reached the limit of memory, writing, and stuff. Even a gentle lady has the right to say enough, not enough, enough.
And that was Dust from Catherine Barrett Sweat's new book, Voice Message. I keep, now that you're reading these poems after explaining the purpose or the title of Voice Message, I keep thinking of poems as voice messages. And the whole process of participating in poetry really is exactly like, you get these voice messages from the past, from John Donne or somebody like that, and then you have your own response, which they can't hear, but somehow it's still an exchange, and you have that whole section of book that's sort of like that, at the very end, the last maybe dozen poems or so. It's a really cool way to think about poetry. So thanks for that. Over on Facebook, Jessica Dawson says. It's not really a question, more a statement, but we'll make it a question. She said, in college several years back, we were told that form wasn't something that editors would be interested in anymore. She says, I loved writing them, and yet I was discouraged by the seemingly lack of acceptance of them. Since then, I have had two acceptances of a sonnet and Villanelle. And and so someone else said something very similar, which I can't find right now. But there is that thing about teachers telling students not to write in form. Why do you think that is? You're a teacher. How do you go about teaching poetry? And I assume you don't tell people not to write in form, right?
No, I don't. We have a poetry workshop in at my school, my high school, and we divide it up, and so the first semester is sort of introduction to poetry, and then the second semester is introduction to form. So I've taught both halves. So yes, I have taught formal poetry, and I really enjoy doing it and introducing kids to it. Recently, we were doing ballad form, and I had the great pleasure of playing them Auden reading when I walked out one evening. And I think listening to him read that poem, it says a lot more than I could about why form matters and why it's kind of silly to dismiss it because it's just another tool like any other. But you can write an incredibly profound and original poem like that in the oldest form, the ballad, and get more antique than that. So, and I think it's true though that it's, I was in a manuscript workshop this fall, and one of the people in the group with me said, "You're so brave, you know, how can you write these poems?" Because she had gone to Iowa, where she said, you know, if you had tried to write anything in meter or rhyme, you would have just been pilloried. So I
Oh,
think
wow.
it's, but I also think it's not true.
Yeah, it's just hard to believe that. But I have to admit that Rattle had a statement when I got here in 2004, and we said we like formal poetry too, but there was something that I can't remember how it was phrased, but we said it was like harder to do than free verse, and so make sure your sonnet is really good or something. That was in the submission guidelines, which I don't know. I always found a little baffling, and I deleted that pretty soon. But
Bad free verse, but not your best.
exactly. It implies like, oh yeah, send your terrible free verse, but just don't send terrible rhyme. And I don't understand where where that came from. But do you think it's do you find it harder to write in free verse now without structure and without sort of rhyme propelling you forward once you get a poem started? Like I always find that if I'm in a phase where I'm writing a lot of form, it's the form itself that gives you like different ideas. You know, like you think of a word that you wouldn't have thought of if you need a certain length or if you need a certain rhyme. Do you find it now hard to write free verse?
I mean, you know, the sort of perhaps the one of the most famous contemporary formalist poets, A.E. Stallings, said, you know, at a certain point she just realized that she was better at the formal version. I haven't reached that. I'm not as experienced as she is, and I haven't written as many books, but I'm tending in that direction. I think that free verse is really, really hard to, because, right, a form demands that you fix it until it's right. And free verse, it's harder to know when you're finished. I guess that's for me the difference.
But you don't think it helps with the creative process itself? Like I always feel like we
Form.
do like we have ways. I always feel like poetry is a communication of the subconscious, and there's certain ways that we learn to turn off our conscious thought so we can let the subconscious communicate. And I always feel like form is one way that people teach themselves to shut their sort of left hemisphere up and let their right hemisphere think. And so, you know, having to focus on the meter and the rhyme like leaves your subconscious free to express itself. I think it's sort of like a juggling, you know, like those things where you know, if you do a quiz and they make you respond and like immediately so that you get the answer that you really believe and not what you think people want to hear. I kind of feel like that's what form writing in form does. Do you find that, or do you think it's more about the re
I think it's about, I was talking about the revision before, but I think that's absolutely true. It's very liberating. I have one of the poets who died recently, that W.S. Merwin, who did write formally for many years, but his later books are not formal verse. And he taught me a lot about how free verse could retain that beautiful structure and music. But without having the absolutely regular meter and rhyme. So when I am in a mood and I can write something like that, then it feels very free, the free verse. But I agree that the structure of the sonnet or a villanelle, villanelles in particular, I think are very liberating. Because once you get that line, then it's how am I going to get back to it? And it does kind of free you.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I feel like most people would think that it's restricting and not liberating, but in my experience that it is liberating too. Do you want to read a couple more?
All right, well, maybe I'll read a villanelle.
Yeah, that'd be good. Good segue.
So there are two villanelles in the book, and I'll read the second one, which is called Winter Light. I wish I could believe that ghosts were true, a flashlight ready when the lights go out, that death could leave behind a bit of you. I pass you on the street. I interview someone who tosses her black hair about. I wish I could believe that ghosts were true. Forget-me-nots return each year in blue. Your brother smiles and something in his mouth. I think death left behind a bit of you. I wear your yellow sweater from J. Crew or hear a piece you practiced on the flute. I can almost believe that ghosts are true. The skin, the voice, the laugh, the it of you grow daily more and more remote. Death's only left behind a bit of you, which isn't you. The winter light comes through your window on a thousand whirling motes. I wish I could believe that ghosts were true and death had left behind a bit of you.
That's a great example of the form that I can almost believe the ghosts are true. Such a great refrain to run through the poem.
And it's true, right? One wishes that ghosts. I think at my age and experience, the idea of a ghost is thrilling.
That I never thought of that either, but that's totally true. Like when I was a kid, I was terrified to go in the basement because it was one of the, dark and creepy, and maybe there's a ghost down there. But now, the thought is sort of is much more appealing. Now that maybe I could get to be one, I guess.
Do you want me to read another?
Yeah.
All right, this is another poem that was in Rattle. It's called City of Refuge. I dream we're exiled to a distant land, a home for careless parents searching for the lost, a place where locals understand we'll never find what we had years before. And when a stranger there makes idle chat, we know he'll know that we have a dead child or two, and he does too. And he'll know that you talk about the dead as if alive. For in the waking world, we hesitate to mention her. We have to make a choice between our neighbors staring at his plate and somehow seeming to have lost his voice, or are just saying that we have no daughter, the way a drunk might say his gin was water.
Yeah, I remember, picking that poem for publication, and just that those last two lines are just so haunting and good. I was gonna ask about what was I gonna ask about? Now I can't even remember. I was gonna ask about your the publishing process, cause that's what, cause somebody else was talking about how they thought editors don't want to deal with form and stuff like that. And do you feel like you had trouble, finding a niche or, sending out submissions? Like, how long have you been sending out submissions and trying to get a book published? Is that something that happened, more seriously after 2010 when your daughter died? Or is that something you've been doing for a long time?
Well, I've been writing poetry for a long time, but I really did start sending things out more seriously, and I stopped sending things to the New Yorker, probably what I was doing in my 20s and 30s, and I might even have gotten a nice letter back from the editor at one point, but I realized that there was a practical thing. I mean, you don't think of poetry as being particularly practical, but So I realize that the formal poems might find an audience in journals that seem to like them. So, yeah. So that I just was more persistent, and I think I got better too.
It like the business of it, like the grunt work of sending stuff out. Oh, the poem was
Got
better. Yeah.
because I was writing more. I just was, and I think I was reading more and just thinking more. Yeah. So, I mean, the earliest poem in this book is almost 30 years old, but most of them are much more recent than that.
What's the oldest poem in the book? Do you want to read that? That might be sort of interesting to see if we can tell the difference.
Yeah, I read it to myself today, and I was like, I don't know if I want to read it, but it's called Mrs. Van Winkle. So it's as in Rip's wife, and I think I felt bad for her because he's always going off and trying to avoid her, and she's the sort of classic shrew in literature. So I was trying to imagine her and what her experience was of marriage to Rip. Called Mrs. Van Winkle. Stuck in the small, in, sorry, stuck in that small sleepy town where the wind blows the dust in most days and the neighbor's cow tramples down the frail lettuces, she flays the trees with her tongue as she strips a chicken of feathers and sweating dismembers its limbs. Glimpsing her man as he slips out the gate with his grin and gun, she remembers how once his hard hips hooked above her thighs, his odd twitch and gasp as she pulled him in to her own triumph caught in his widening eyes. Those lines that use has pulled so thin, she still tries to knot with rage, to flog his impotence, his affection for the dog.
Oh, yeah, that's still just as good as a newer poem, I think. Did you revise this a lot, or is it sort of how it originally was 30 years ago?
It's how it was. I once heard Charles the poet Charles Simic speak, and he talked about revision, and of course we poets revise a lot, but he talked about revising old work and how you do it and then you realize that the poem was flawed and you wrote it when you were young, but that it's like an old awkward friend and you don't want to change it.
Well, we're
So
totally different people than we were when we wrote it. You know, if it's an older poem, like, you know, tw 20 years ago, I mean, just not the person I am right now. And we just change and grow, and we don't even have the same cells in our body. So it's always interesting to read old poems, and it is like talking to an old friend who you don't quite relate to as much anymore, like a friend from high school or something, on a class reunion.
yeah, try to remember where were you? I actually see where I was when I wrote that poem. So that's a kind of nice thing that happens with poems is that they bring back your own past to you.
Do you write a lot and then like save stuff that's not published and look back at it, or do you sort of just write and flush it down the toilet if it doesn't work?
Well, I write by hand initially, so it's all sitting in notebooks. So not much gets flushed down the toilet. I mean, there's no waste paper basket anymore, right? I'm not going to rip a page out of my notebook. That would ruin the beautiful notebook. And then I go to the computer where, everything is there at in some form or other. So it's harder to get rid of stuff than it used to be. But I do lots of stuff that never gets out of the notebook and onto the computer.
Why by hand, do you think? Is there a reason?
I'm old. But I like it. It's tactile. And I like pencils because I can erase. And yet I see the erasure. Feels good. But then for a lot of, and I even do some revision in my notebooks. I'll sometimes, go to the opposite page. But at a certain point, I go on to the keyboard. But I do rarely compose on the keyboard. Once in a while, I do.
Yeah, I can't. I find I can't write by hand because I can't keep up. Like my handwriting is too slow and sloppy, and if I've tried, it's always like my brain is 8 steps ahead of my hand, and it's just too frustrating. Jillian has a question. Jillian here. She is spinning off. I think I mentioned, or you mentioned, that a poem is sort of a container for emotion, like grief. And she asks, do you find that it gives the emotion a validation? Because you can recognize it, name it, own it, and validate it.
Yeah, and shape it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think if I came back, I would be a great singer or a great painter, right? So I think writers, we have envy of other art forms that seem such a more direct emotional capacity. But for me, yes, poetry is where I can put a lot of emotion. Though I do feel bad if like people will say, "Oh, your poem made me cry," and I don't know. I feel a little bad that my poem made me cry.
Well, crying is good though. Like to have an experience that makes you feel something, is, I mean, it's the same thing. I always compare it to like skydiving or something. It's like a broad mental skydiving to read a really good poem that takes the top of your head off. But to be taken somewhere, like you'd say, skydiving is terrifying and it's miserable, but it's also a thrilling rush that makes you more alive. And I think
Wait, you've
that's what the
done
poetry.
Scott?
I have not. I'm imagining what it would be like. I would not go skydiving, but I can imagine, or a lot of other things that I would not do. But some people love that, and some people love journeying through those mental skydives, And I think it's somehow related.
Yeah.
Let me see. A lot of people are saying in the chat that they write by hand too, so you're not alone. I
And then
find
you get stationery stores and pick up nice notebooks. So it's.
that's true. Do you feel like it like creates a sacred space or something, having a journal that's like a nice paper and things like that? Like I'm getting into the serious business of writing, and I'm gonna treat it respectfully, or is that kind of part of it, you think?
It's also transportable, so it's a defined space, the notebook. And some people always use the same kind of notebooks. They have a sort of fetish. They have to have this exact kind of spiral bound notebook or Borum and Peace heart ledger book or something. But I actually like different covers so that they mark a different year or something. But I like the same basic size, and it means I can write my poems in the dining room or in the living room or in bed or even on the bus or the train. So I do like that way that you can take that space. And I guess you could say the same thing about a computer, but I do all my work on a computer. I write email. So this is has one purpose and it's transportable. So that's what I.
Yeah, that's a good point too that I never thought of. That like if you're having trouble sleeping, they say don't do anything in bed besides sleep, because then you're training yourself that space is a space for sleep. But I type stupid emails all day on the computer, and so of course it doesn't feel like a special space for writing. No one's asked this yet, but people ask this all the time. Who are your favorite people to read right now? Are there certain poets that you really admire and are enjoying lately?
Well, I do like A. Stallings a lot, and let me think. And Merwin, I have to say, he's extraordinary. And in terms of older people, I guess Auden and Frost and Bishop. Actually, I've been reading Bishop a lot during the coronavirus. I find her very serene, and I mean, she's not serene. She's edgy and ironic, but there's something about her that she's just her mind is so clear, I guess I'm getting at more
And
than
there's some
serious.
of her poems that seem like they're about the coronavirus. I don't know if you've seen or noticed that, but a few people have like posted them on Facebook or whatever, and I'm like, whoa, it's like she's channeling the future or something. Wish I could remember the title of one off the top of my head that I'm thinking of, but yeah. Do you want to, we have like 4 minutes left. Do you want to finish off with a poem? or
Okay.
two, if they like sonnets.
Yeah, why don't I do a couple of sonnets? I'm gonna do one that's about it's about a son. It's called Storage. He puts away sports trophies, childish things, throws out the Simpson doll he loved at 12, clears out some space for new books on the shelves. The Sartre next to the Fellowship of the Ring, Brothers K, Das Kapital, The Wings of the Dove. How quickly adolescence delves into the multiplicity of selves that 16 years in one small bedroom bring. A bit of Lego buried in the rug's worn pile reminds me of the 8-year-old, happy to talk, so casual with hugs. His voice was high and shoulders not so broad. And now the younger boy is safely stored inside the one whose look can stop me cold. That's for parents whose children giving all time and they're in very close quarters, right?
Yeah, that was one of the poems I really enjoyed. I have a 5-year-old son, and so imagining him inside of the teenager he's gonna be, being like, "Mom, where's the sunny D?" You know, is I enjoyed that poem a lot. Thanks.
Enjoy the Lego and all the things that irritate you now.
Yeah, he is obsessed with the Lego.
Yes. Yeah, some children really get into Lego. Well, I usually close with this one, so I think I will again. It's a summer poem, and it refers to the classical Chinese poet, another poet I really love reading, Tu Fu. And it's called, and it's another poem that in it's about my husband. Late this summer night, I read you some translations of Tu Fu, as all around tree shadows on the lawn sparkle with the flashy multitude of fireflies that show up every June. The government decays, but they appear, a disco frenzy stretching to the sky, above our heads, below, in front, to the rear, impossible to trace with just the eye. The night comes late, the air feels warm and wet. Our dinner's done, but it is good to drink with bats, bullfrogs, pond moon. Good to forget how many states we've seen rise up and sink, how many summers we've seen disappear, and wondered if we'd see what comes next year.
Excellent. This Late Summer by Catherine Barrett Sweat from her newest book, Voice Message. Thanks so much for joining us, Catherine. It was really a pleasure hearing your poems and getting to talk to you. Hope you have a nice week and stay safe.
Yeah, you too. Thanks so much, Jim. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, good night.
Good night.
Yes, that was Catherine Barrett Sweat. Her book is from Autumn House Press, which you can find. Put the website on the screen if you can see it. That's Autumn House Press at autumnhouse.org, just like it sounds. Pick up a copy if you can. It's a really great book, especially if you like formal poetry. Let's see. So there's 56 people watching still on YouTube and only 17 likes. So just click that like button for me. It really helps. It tells the algorithms that this is broadcasting that people want to read. So I really appreciate it if you could do that. And hope you're enjoying the show. We meet like this every Tuesday night with a new poet. I might as well say right now, next week's guest is going to be Charles Harper Webb, Rattlecast number 37. Charles Harper Webb is the first poet we published way back in issue number 4, I think. I mean, not the first poet we published, the first poet we interviewed. It was Alan's very first interview. And maybe we'll have to talk about that because I've heard the story about how Alan had no idea how to do an interview and was terrified and walked in and was terrified through the whole interview. So I wonder if Charles picked up on that. But we'll see what Charles Harper Webb's been up to. His newest book is Sidebend World from, I think that's Pitt Press. So we'll talk to Charles Harper Webb. Very entertaining poet, one of those poets we've published a whole bunch of times. Now, we also have a open mic for a prompt every week. And this is to encourage everybody to write poems because writing poems is a wonderful thing to do. Now, last week's prompt was a happy love poem. It's harder than it sounds. Try to avoid cliches. And all these poems are from, all these prompts are done by Megan, Rattle's assistant editor, and my wife, who's in the next room over. And I was a terrible husband and did not write the prompt poem this week either. I really should have written a happy love poem. But I am overwhelmed trying to read all of our Chapbook Prize submissions. We're supposed to announce the winner on April 15th, and I am just reading manuscript after manuscript, so I didn't write anything this week, but Megan did. And this is what she wrote for her own prompt. This is Precipitation. And now this better be about me and not Todd, her ex-boyfriend from 20 years ago, because I don't know who else she'd write a love poem for, if you know what I mean. So let's see. This is Precipitation. Sometimes when the day is done, it has washed us clean like a light, baptismal rain. We come together and make each other softer, like snow falling on snow. Sometimes the day is a dust storm and our bodies are clouds of it. And when we come together, what we give each other parches us. And on those days, we go our separate ways, but I can hear you typing, and you can hear me humming, and when the sky opens again, it will cover everything. That's a really, really nice poem. Thanks so much. Megan's a great poet, so part of the reason I'm doing these prompts is to make her write stuff, because she's a much better writer than me, and she hasn't been writing. So I'm glad we could make her write poems, and I like that poem a lot. Let's see, and now next up we have Caitlin Buxbaum, and we have audio from her. Now, if you wrote a prompt poem this week for this week's prompt, there's a few things you can do. You can email it to openmic@rattle.com. Then I can show the poem on screen like Caitlin did. You can include audio so I can just play it like Caitlin did. You can also call up and let me put the numbers up on the screen. The phone number to call in is 818-850-7727, or you can send me a chat message over Skype, and that's Rattle Poetry, all one word, and I will call you when I get a chance. Let's see. And Carrie Radna says she, let's see, was it a love poem for the prompt? Yeah, so we're fixing these open mics to the prompt. And so it has to be a poem that was written after the prompt, because we want to encourage people to write poems, because writing poems is a really great thing to do, even though I didn't do it myself this week. So this is Caitlin Buxbaum's poem. I keep clicking the wrong one. Sonnet number one. She wrote two sonnets for us. And here they go. This is sonnet number one by Caitlin Buxbaum.
Sonnet one. The familiar lightness of your sure hands upon my naked hip, lip, breast, or brow speaks to the marked tenderness of man, the exquisite infinity of now. If the working hours in a day run long in the cloudy absence of your soft voice, I will know, we will know, I was not wrong to confidently make this endless choice of living in your warm, generous arms, mapping the scattered freckles on your face, as, with your touch, you silence all alarms and carry us with ever-flowing grace. May we live content 1,000-odd years, unburdened by our callous doubts and fears.
That was a Caitlin Buxbaum.
Astral, Sonnet 2.
Well, here's Astral Sonnet 2.
If I were an ancient astronomer, and your skin a pale sky of widespread stars, I would smile and gladly take forever just to chart with awe the few faded scars. Gazing at your ever-astral body, I could while away the rest of my days, watching freckles form or pile and eddy in unending celestial arrays. But if the long governing sun had eyes to see the spangled marks you've left on me, he'd forget his duty to stay and rise each day to help us form a galaxy. We won't trust our stellar love to science, but unite in heavenly defiance.
That was Caitlin Buxbaum reading two sonnets that she wrote for the prompt this week. Caitlin is an overachiever. And she's also the founder of Red Sweater Press in Wasilla, Alaska. You can check out more about Red Sweater Press at redsweaterpress.com. So thanks so much for sharing those, Caitlin. She's here live a lot, but she said she's got another online workshop at the same time tonight. So she sent those over email, which is great. So thanks so much, Caitlin. Now, the next up, we have Sean King. And here's Sean King's poem from the prompt Shared Vision.
Shared vision. Are we? Look it, look. What, over? I've never. It's, you have to the right or behind, but wait, I'm not, did it? No, it's still, just if you, I don't know if, maybe, you will, if it doesn't, has it, where did, a little to, there, did you, if it's the, is it, more to, oh, there, was that, why am I, oh my God, I hope, I see it too.
So, there's another poem, oops, another poem that was Matthew King, an excellent one, and I'm glad that I didn't read it because that would have been tough to read, but that was a great poem, Shared Vision. And Sean, or Matthew King, lives near Wollaston Lake in Ontario, Canada, and you can find his nature photography, which I mentioned before, is really good at birdsandbeesandblooms.com. Now, for next week, the open or the prompt poem is going to be, this is one I can probably take care of. I can probably do this. This is a erasure poem using a news article from the past week. So this week it's sort of a Poet Respond. You could even submit it to Poet Respond if you want, if you do it by Friday. But that's next week's prompt, an erasure poem using a news article from the past week. And if you don't know, probably most people do, but if you don't, an erasure poem is where you take a body of text and then just black out sections of it to make a totally new poem that says something different. So that's an erasure poem. So write one this week and then submit it to openmic@rattle.com. And we can share it next week. I'll do one too. That's something I can find a little time to do. Well, I shouldn't promise. I just have so much work this week. But I'll do my best and try. So once again, thanks so much for joining us. That is our show for tonight. Hope you enjoyed it. The guest, once again, was Catherine Barrett Sweat and her new book, Voice Message, which you can get from Autumn House Press. And next week's guest is going to be Charles Harper Webb and his new book, Side Bend World. Charles has been in a whole bunch of issues of Rattle. And like I said earlier, he was the first poet that we ever interviewed for an issue. So he's been around for a while, and I think he's published about 24 books since the time we interviewed him first in 1997, 1998, whenever that was. So I'm looking forward to seeing Charles Harper Webb next week. Hope you can join me then. I should say really quick, too, that we have open mic show now every Sunday. It's going to be, the time is wrong. I forgot to update that. We're going to move it up 2 hours. So it's going to be noon Eastern time or 2 a.m. Pacific time. So it's first thing in the morning. We'll compete with all those Sunday morning talk shows, and we'll share poems and talk about the news through poetry. I'll share the poems that we published for Poet Respond that weekend and explain why I like those poems. And we'll also share your poems through the open mic and explore the world through verse, which is always a lot of fun. So I hope you join me for that. In the meantime, I will see you next week for Charles Harper Webb. Have a great night and stay safe. Good night.